I'd like now to welcome Robin Dunbar. He's a professor of evolutionary psychology at the University of Oxford, and he will be speaking tonight in a lecture, Why the Internet Won't Get You Any More Friends. It's sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute, and it's at the James A. Little Theater at 7:30 on the campus of the New Mexico School for the Deaf. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Pleasure to be here, Mary Charlotte.
So you have come up with a number which is called the Dunbar number, which is the, if I understand it correctly, outer limit of the number of friends that any person can really have. 150 seems kind of low in this world.
You might think so, but actually if you look at people's Facebook web pages, the number of friends they have listed there, it's pretty much in that kind of ballpark. I have to say, the 150 is the average for kind of all of us. So some of us have fewer and some of us have more than 150. But kind of, you know, 150 is the kind of ballpark figure. And I should point out that includes your relatives as well, the whole of your extended family. They're not all friends.
Well, right. And so kinship versus friendship is something that you talk about. Kinship is sort of weirdly closer.
Kinship is very weird stuff, really. Well, you can understand that we kind of, you know, feel very close to our immediate family, your mum and dad or your brothers and sisters or your children, maybe your cousins and so on. But kinship really extends out beyond that to quite distant relatives, second cousins, you know, maybe third cousins. And it's kind of weird that, you know, somebody can come knocking on your door and say, hi, you know, I'm your third cousin once removed because we share a great-great-grandmother somewhere or other way back in the past. And suddenly it's a sort of, well, do come and stay, you know, we've never met before, but somehow we have this link. Whereas if somebody who did that and said, hello, I'm a friend of a friend of a friend of yours, you'd kind of say, well, actually, there's a very good hostel down the road. Why don't you pop round some time for a cup of tea? It's the sort of big, we don't really understand why that happens psychologically, what the motivation of it is. But there's something about the nature of family, as it were, which is just at those levels, a linguistic category. We name, you know, you only know that these people are related to you because somebody has said, you know, you share some relatives somewhere in the past.
And it might even be kinship by marriage.
It can indeed be kinship by marriage. That's perfectly true. And in fact, interestingly, we treat our in-laws as very much the way we treat our true close family, just slightly less close, but perhaps not too much less close. And there's a very good biological reason why that should be, and that, of course, is that, like true family, genetic family, your in-laws share a genetic interest with you in the children and grandchildren that you will presumably produce in the future. So, you know, they have a very good reason to be interested in you, which is not too dissimilar to the reasons that, you know, your real family or genetic family, that's to say, should be interested in your well-being and your future and the future of your children and grandchildren.
So what's the difference between a friend, whether it be kin or just a close friend, and an acquaintance?
Well, I mean, I guess what's happened is the kind of internet social networking sites have muddied the waters a little bit because, you know, they've called all these people friends, which is fine because in one sense, clearly they are. But there are clearly categories of friendship. And you know, if you like, the biggest divide is that between kin, family, as it were, and non-related people whom you wouldn't perhaps normally call friends. But even within that, we don't have any trouble differentiating between the fact that some people are intimate friends. They're the people that you like to hang out with every weekend, that you spend a lot of time with, they're fun to be with, they help you out. Sort of people who are perhaps good friends, but you don't see them quite as often, and sort of a general category of more distant friends whom you'll pick up with now and again, perhaps. And then beyond that, acquaintances, they're people you know, but you probably wouldn't invite them back for dinner on Saturday night or to a party if you were having them one, perhaps. But that distinction really seems also to hinge around how altruistic you would be to them. And it also reflects, at the same time, the effort you put into keeping that relationship going. And this is the big difference between family relationships, kinship relationships, and friendship relationships is kinship, you don't have to invest so much time and effort in. Those relationships will keep going, ticking over at about the same level, even if you don't see those people for years and years and years. But if you don't see your friends on a regular basis, the quality of that relationship plummets very, very fast. And people who were once intimate friends, within 5 or 6 years, can just become acquaintances, somebody I once knew.
Except for that rare person that you knew, for example, in high school or college, and 20 years later you see them again and you pick up as if no time had gone by.
Absolutely. I think that's a very, very special category of friendship. But if you look at who that is, and this is very clear. I mean, it's very funny sometimes talking about this to teenagers, high school kids, because they'll all say, "Oh, but my best friends are my best friends forever, and I'm never going to change." And of course, they do, except for one little category of people, and it really is often only two or three people at the most. And they're the people you did a lot with. You really, it's a lot of emotional activity going on in your friendship, as it were, and you were sharing problems and all this kind of thing, but you're also doing a lot of things like dancing or singing in the choir or playing basketball or whatever it was you did at that age. And that little handful of friendships seemed to somehow develop, if you like, the psychology that's a bit more like family relationships. And they can, you can not see these people for 20 or 30 years and then you see them again down the line and you just pick up that relationship exactly where it was. But that's very unusual among friendships. Most friendships, if you don't keep oiling them, servicing them in the way we would think of servicing a car, the whole thing will sort of gradually deteriorate.
Are there cultural differences that you've seen with this? And I ask because I have a good friend. He was actually my father's best friend who was British, who married an Italian. And he was talking about one of the big cultural differences between him and his wife was that he put so much love and attention and effort into his friends, whereas she put that same love and attention and effort into her family.
That probably reflects much more. I don't think it's a, as far as we, let's put it this way, as far as we can see from all the work we and others have done, there aren't massive cultural differences in the way you treat family or friends generally. But probably one of the important ones is how big your family is. Because even within our kind of Western European, North and Western European kind of societies where families are small, you don't have these big Mediterranean families like the Italians and the Spaniards still do. We still give priority. Our data show very nicely. We give priority to family before we start slotting friends in. So it's as though in your 150, you put all your family in. If you've got any slots left over, then you have friends. And many people have commented on this to me when I've talked about it and said, "Oh, yes, I come from a very big family. My husband, as one particular example I remember, comes from a very small family. And I have no friends because my life is taken up with keeping up with what's going on in the family. And I just don't have any other time left over." But my husband, having no family to speak of, very small, has lots and lots of friends. So, and I think that's the big difference. And I would guess that's the explanation in this case, that as an Italian, they're largely coming from big extended families. And so there's a lot of work to do. It's not that families, you don't have to invest so much to keep the relationship at the same level as you do with friendships, but that you have this commitment with family which you feel obliged to keep going. And of course, there's another big difference between family and friends, is family is a very tightly integrated network. Everybody's talking to everybody else. So if you don't go to Aunt Jemima's 80th birthday party, it is noticed. Whereas friendships tend to be much less kind of densely interconnected, and therefore, if you don't go to somebody's 40th birthday party, the others don't find out or they don't particularly care so much. So that, there's that kind of, it's not exactly policing, is it? But, you know, there's a reputational issue that flows around families that keeps everybody both informed as to what's going on, keeps them updated with the news, your news, but also, you know, feeds back to you when you've misbehaved or not turned up at the right event and these kind of things.
We're talking to Professor of Evolutionary Psychology, Robin Dunbar. So what is the significance of all of this? I mean, the effects of, or the outcomes of the issues that you're talking about have to do, above all, with loyalty and social cohesion.
There are two important outcomes of, if you like, friendships and the nature of our sort of extended social networks and how they work. One is it is, if you like, upwards into the wider community. So as our societies get bigger and more scattered geographically and so on, we constantly bump up against this problem of social cohesion. So trying to extend the networks that we live in so that they include larger and larger number of peoples to give society itself greater coherence and greater cohesion so that we're more, kind of more committed, as it were, to the grand project that we all represent. That's really a crucial outcome. I mean, if we don't solve that problem properly, we're going to be in deep trouble, I suspect. The other side of the coin is, if you like, downwards, and here it comes back to you and your personal health and life satisfaction. There's a lot of evidence now that the size of your social network, and in particular the size of your kinship network, so, you know, we all have small families these days and we have very small kinship networks. That's, you might think, a worry in this context. But the size and how well interconnected your extended network is has dramatic effects on things like your health and well-being, your resistance to diseases of all kinds, your ability to recover from surgery or whatever it is, and even your chances of dying. And it's been suggested that the impact of your network size and quality, if you like, the number of friends you have and how good they are, and how helpful they are to you, has as big an impact on your risk of dying as giving up smoking. That's enormous.
Amazing. Now, this size, the number of people in our network, has everything to do with how we evolved as primates and how we evolved as hunter-gatherers.
That's correct. Basically, it turns out that there's a relationship between the size of social groups that a species of monkey or ape typically lives in, and the size of its brain, basically. And this is because all primates, all monkeys and apes, live in very complex social systems. They're kind of like implicit social contracts, in that the members, you know, are sort of collaborating together as a kind of community to solve the problems of life and death. But if, in order to do that, it means you have to kind of give up some of your more selfish personal interests in order to keep the group together and allow everybody to get their fair share out of the deal. And the complexity of that really demands these big brains. So they need a big computer to keep this very complicated social world going. And if you look at our place in that, we sit very nicely exactly where we should be on the equation relating brain size to group size in monkeys and apes, or particularly the ape. We are a member of the ape family, if you like.
So bigger-brained creatures have more close friends, so to speak?
Yes, but this is only true of monkeys and apes. It's not true of animals and birds and mammals
prairie
in general.
Dogs.
Prairie dogs. It's because most of them build their societies in a very different way to the way monkeys and apes do. There are some exceptions. One of those exceptions is the horse family, and every horse owner and horse lover will know that really well. But most of the other, and maybe the elephants and the dolphin family are the other two main candidates. But generally, for primates, you think of the, for mammals in general, you think of kind of antelope herds or cattle herds as the kind of archetypal social system for them. They're kind of here today and gone tomorrow. You see a herd, you can join it. It's not too difficult. If you get fed up, you can leave. With monkey and ape societies, they're much more kind of built on these very tight bonded relationships between very close friends. And you can't just walk into these. It takes a long time. They tend to resist incomers coming into it because this is basically a self-protecting community, really, that bonds together to protect themselves against the sort of risks of life in general, particularly for monkeys and apes. This is things like predators or attacks by other groups, for example. We have that same psychology. It's just that we have it on a scale which is, you know, several orders greater. You know, we can just manage much bigger social systems.
So monkeys do this. You have a background studying primates, studying baboons. How does what human beings do resemble what primates do, and how is it different?
I spent the first half of my research career as a scientist studying baboons and other monkeys in Africa, sort of in the Jane Goodall mode, as it were, following them around in the forests and the grasslands. Anybody who's worked on monkeys and apes will tell you that it's just like watching the soap opera of everyday life. You know, there are friendships and friendships fall out, and there are power cliques and all these kind of things going on. There's a lot of machinating going around and scheming and so on. And at that level, and the level of sort of how they build their friendships, if you like, and their friendships are kind of little supportive cliques, you know, they help each other out. It's done mainly through grooming and just being there and spending time. But on top of that, because it's done through grooming, which is a physical activity, we still do it. But with us, it's restricted to, well, I suppose it is in primates, really, to very close relationships. So patting and petting and, you know, sort of leafing through people's hair, right, and things the way we still do. This is the sort of provides the glue that builds that relationship. And you have to invest a certain amount of time in doing that with an individual to create a relationship, a friendship, if you like, of a particular strength. So it's a time investment problem for them. And it still is with us. We do this sort of close, intimate primate cuddling and petting stuff with the appropriate people, very close friends and family. But we also have developed or, if you like, acquired these mechanisms for extending that process outwards to larger people. Because the problem with grooming, as it is with us still, is it's so intimate, it is a one-to-one. You know, you can't do it with three or four people at the same time. But as we, in our course of our evolutionary history, needed to have bigger and bigger social groups, so we needed a mechanism which kind of extended the grooming group. And we think the first step on the way to that was laughter. Laughter actually has the same chemical effects in the brain as grooming does.
And dancing.
And then, yes, well, that's the sort of phase two, if you like, because the laughter works very well because we can laugh with several people. But it turns out that natural laughter groups are, in fact, quite small. They're three people. So you can see now they're more efficient than a grooming group, which is two people. Already you've expanded the size of the group, but still there's an upper limit on the number of people you can laugh with.
What do you mean? You go to a performance with a stand-up comedian, you've got 1,000 people in a hall and they're all laughing.
So you may think. But actually, next time you do that, have a look around at what's happening. And two things will be very striking is, first of all, not everybody is laughing at the same time, right? What you get is a kind of Mexican wave effect going through the audience. Not always sort of in the form of a Mexican wave from one side to the other, but you've got little pockets laughing, and they will trigger people near them and so on. So you get this sort of flow backwards and forwards. If you really watch what happens, it's mostly little pockets of people who are sitting together, who are doing that laughing. And we think probably the reason it works is they're setting up a kind of little natural group of two or three of you that go to the comedy show. You and the comedian on the stage are forming this little sort of laughter group. And the comedian can do it with several little groups at the same time, as it were, in the audience. And that's why you get the big audience effect. But actually, they're very small and intimate things. I mean, the comedian is not in any way involved in a personal relationship with the little group of people on rows 32 and 33 right. that are laughing at that particular moment. But just the way the process works, because laughter is incredibly socially facilitated. It's very, very difficult to not laugh when the people you're with laugh, even if you don't understand the joke. If the two or three people you're sitting with laugh, and there's a classic case of this, as if you go to some completely foreign country where you don't even understand the language, and somebody tells a joke around the table and they're all laughing, it's unbelievably impossible to stop laughing yourself. You have no idea what's going on, but you have to. This incredibly social activity that laughter is.
Do animals laugh?
Certainly the apes do, but in fact, the laughter vocalization we have is a kind of derivative of the monkey play vocalization. So in monkeys, it's very, very similar in form. Monkeys give it when they're inviting play or engaged in play, and it's a kind of signal not to take this too seriously. When I bite you, don't think I'm attacking you. This is play, right? So it's kind of what's referred to in ethology as a meta signal, as it were, a comment on what's going on. Great apes use it more extensively, that same vocalization in play and social context. And all we've done is change the dynamics of it a little bit so that it becomes much more exhausting for us. And that's why it produces the same bonding effect.
We're talking to Professor of Evolutionary Psychology, Robin Dunbar. So talk about the bonding effects. There are chemical and hormonal effects of things like laughter and dancing and grooming and all those bonding activities.
So the reason these activities like grooming and laughter and dancing and singing work is that they trigger in the brain the release of a neuropeptide whose name is endorphins. So that's a whole family of them, but it seems to be a particular member of that family that does the trick. Now, this particular neuropeptide, the beta endorphins, are part of the pain control system. And so what they really do is that they're opiates. I mean, they're related to morphine and opium and these kind of things. There's a slight chemical difference that is critical because it means we don't get addicted to our own opioid chemicals in the brain, as it were, and perhaps explains why we do get addicted to these other ones from that we get from the poppy and so on, other kinds of plants. But they basically work by making us feel very relaxed and happy. They have this kind of analgesic effect. And when you feel happy and relaxed like that, and you know the world has no cares, and when you're doing that with somebody as an integrated activity with them, be it grooming, be it laughing, be it dancing or singing in a coordinated way, then you get this sort of upwelling of kind of goodwill and bonding to that individual. So we're kind of locked in by what I always refer to as a very cheap chemical trick, really. But all that does, in some sense, is allow us to enjoy spending time with this individual. So we want to do more of it, and that allows us to build a kind of relationship at a cognitive sort of level, a relationship that is where the basis of it really is, you know, reciprocity and trust and a sense of obligation. So this is a sort of psychological level, as it were. So you've got this sort of pharmacological level that makes it possible to have this bonded relationship, but and that then in turn produces this kind of behavioral or psychological relationship, which allows you then to provide support and help to each other in that close friendship.
Which in turn has adaptive significance and advantage for a group of hunter-gatherers or monkeys or whatever it
yes,
is.
Yes, indeed. And it does still for us because, you know, this is why it seems you have this massive effect of the number and quality of your friendships on your general psychological well-being, your, you know, risk of not dying, if we can put it that way, all these kind of things. And you know, laughter is very good for that. I mean, people who are enabled to laugh a lot just need less analgesics after a surgery, for example. They recover more quickly because it seems that the endorphins somehow tune the immune system and get the thing working really well to kind of resist all these dreadful onslaughts that the world constantly throws at you in the form of bacteria and viruses and all these kind of things, and improves the healing process quite dramatically as a result. So that's why that effect occurs. But it really does extend out into music making in a very big way. And people who, you know, sing regularly in a choir will know this. I mean, you go in feeling grumpy and down at heel and so on, and then, you know, you spend an hour or two in your choir practice and you come out of it just feeling wonderful. You know?
Same thing for salsa dancing.
Salsa dancing is another good one, yes.
We live in this funny world where we have so many virtual experiences that are kind of like those natural experiences that we evolved with and kind of not. So you have, I mean, I could sit at home all day long watching South Park and laughing uproariously by myself, but there's not a bonding experience with another person. I could, and many people do this, go online and go into chat rooms and form emotional relationships with people who you don't see and touch and smell, and things that feel like falling in love or getting angry and those things happen without any contact.
That's certainly true that, if you like, the online world as we're now experiencing it can produce this sense of a close relationship with somebody. There's a very good reason why that should be, and that is simply that that's how we naturally do it anyway. And the archetypal example of that, of course, is falling in love with somebody. When you fall in love with somebody, you don't actually fall in love, dare I say it, sorry listeners, the person who's actually there. What you fall in love with is a kind of avatar which you create in your mind of this person. You kind of dress them up, you know, with this halo rainbow around them, and they're wonderful. And interestingly enough, there's a very good reason why you should do that, because it turns out that how long your relationship lasts depends on how rosy the picture you paint right at the beginning. So the rosier it is, the longer it will last.
How can you study that?
Well, it's just kind of looking it's partly done from people's recollections, as it were, but it's also done prospectively over periods of time, sort of 3 or 4 year periods, because, you know, relationships fall apart quite these days quite quickly, it seems. So you can actually, you know, follow through over quite a short period of time the history of a relationship from its early days, as it were, to the point at which it falls apart. But in general terms, you know, we seem to work like this. Now, what happens in the real world, including, of course, in romantic relationships, is there's a bit of ground truthing that goes on sooner or later, because you're constantly obviously seeing this person and dealing with them and talking with them. And so, you know, every so often they do something which undermines your rosy spectacles. And, you know, that keeps it sort of in balance. And it also allows your reality check from time to time. And in fact, you know, courtship has been kind of described as a sort of series of reality checks. You know, you go so far and you think, do I want this to carry on or do I pull out now? And then you go to the next higher level and you come take another reality check. And, you know, at some point you decide, that's enough. I think I'll go somewhere else. Or it blossoms and carries on to its final denouement, as it were. The problem with online versions of this is there's no reality check, and this is why online you're very susceptible to these kind of romantic scams. And if you look at the way they work, they really are very clever, because the one thing they won't do is give you the reality checks. So they will send you photographs of some Greek god or Greek goddess, which keeps this sort of picture going in your mind until you're so deeply in it you actually can't get out. No amount of reality will actually dig you back out, and this is where it starts to become a big problem. I happen to know somebody who works on this and advises the British police force on romantic scams, and she said, you can go along with the police, knock on the door and say, this person is scamming you, this is they're going to rob you. You can apparently convince the person that this is actually happening, and then you go away thinking you've solved the problem. 2 weeks later, they're back in contact again, because they simply won't believe that this is actually a scam. They think, this can't be true. This is the nicest person. They've said such nice things to me, and we are of like minds, and all these kind of things that we use. And it's because they keep their distance, until it's too late for you to dig yourself back out. You've gone over the top and committed yourself. And the result is romantic scams in particular cost billions of dollars every year. And, it's not only that, of course, there's an inordinate amount of heartbreak when you finally realize, you've just sold your house and given all your money away to this person and they've run off